Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to this special edition of the 40 Scenes Fire American Soccer Show as we discuss the recent issues of going on here with the North American Soccer League. They have lost, of course, as everyone knows, they've lost their Division II sanctioning from U.S. Soccer, and of course, they have filed the North American Soccer League a lawsuit when it comes to these sort of things, and of course, we're going to discuss this right now. Joining me currently is Nipun Chopra, as well as Kartik Krishnayar. Of course, Nipun Chopra from Sock Takes in Indianapolis, Kartik Krishnayar from World Soccer Talk, and Neil Morris is joining us from WRAL Sports Fan. Gentlemen, before I allow you to come into the conversation, I just want to talk to my buddy for a second here, if you don't mind, guys. And, you know, Rocco, I got to talk to you, Rocco, because, you know, we're neighbors in a certain way, you and I. What? You don't know this, Rocco? I'm from the Bronx. You're from the Bronx, Rocco. Rocco, you're from Neerit Avenue. I'm from the Grand Concourse and East 202nd Street. Rocco, I heard you on the press conference, Rocco. And Rocco, how much you love to wax poetically about Serie A, guess what? You're getting on my nerves. Because the New York Cosmos is not a charity, Rocco. You're supposed to care about what's going on in the sport of soccer in the United States. But every time you talk, you want to talk about Serie A and how much more popular it is than MLS. You know what, Rocco? I'm popular than American soccer. Rocco, you're getting on my nerves, Rocco. You're getting on my nerves. Either try and do your job the right way to try and help your fellow clubs if you can and in your league that you're trying to remain afloat, or just sell the Cosmos and get out because I've had enough. And how dare you disrespect the American soccer media on this conference call? How dare you disrespect these hardworking men that wants to cover the league that the club that you own is in? So do me a favor, Rocco. Either just try and survive or get out and own a Serie A side and just do that. All right, I'm done. I had to talk to my neighbor in the Bronx there because He had to get a little something from me. Neil Morris first. Neil, first of all, thank you very much for sharing the press conference that you had on your Introverted Triangle Soccer podcast show. Neil, look, I can understand why they got to do what they got to do, but the way that this whole thing was done in the middle just infuriated me. It sounds like he also pointed his verbal finger at Nipun Chopra, who was also in the press conference. Neil, that in my book is disrespectful, and this man should be careful.
Well, first, inverted triangle, although it does feel like introverted triangle. It does feel like an introverted podcast at some time, oftentimes. very often. look. I listened into the podcast, and I did not think that it went well from a public relations point of view. Again, was it the worst thing I'd ever heard? No. Should things have been finessed better? Yes, given what the entire point of the press conference or the media call was, and knowing, frankly, you have to know your audience. I mean, you've got some folks who are calling into those things who may be semi-sympathetic to your plight, and you know, understand that. You've also got some folks calling in who are not, and you're going to have to tailor your responses in such a way that you're not going to give folks who are probably ready to pounce an excuse to do so. What's interesting, you know, I'm going to come at this from a slightly different angle. I'm not going to pile on Rocco. Rocco is what he is, and he's probably built himself a very successful career being who he is. So, you know, was I taken aback by him sort of leaping all over folks who were asking legitimate questions? Yes, and he shouldn't have done that. But, and by the way, Jeffrey Kessler was pretty aggressive as well. I don't want to lay it all at the feet of Rocco. Jeffrey Kessler is somebody who's an attorney and was being every bit as slightly antagonistic as Mr. Camiso. The angle I want to come at from this was, you know, I heard a discussion, I think I was listening to the Tailgate Show last night that Kardik and Nipun were on, and there was a discussion about this, who, you know, should have been the spokesperson for the league. Rocco's the chairman of the board of governors of the league. Who it should have been or could have been. And what occurred to me is not who it should or could have been, but who it was supposed to be if you go back a year. Now, there was a discussion by these two guys about Steve Malik. Well, Steve Malik was kind of the front man for the league around the sanctioning saga last year, but after that he got a seat on the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors. So he never wanted to be chairman of the NASL Board of Governors, and really after he got on the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors, he couldn't. He couldn't be the front man for the league anymore. What's emblematic of some of the struggles that this league has had is who really was supposed to be that person yesterday. And these guys were running down a list of people that it could have been. Well, if you go back 12 months ago, we all know who it would have been if they could have picked somebody. It would have been Brian Helmick. That's who it would have been. But that's not even a consideration now. Why? Because Helmick, who was supposed to be sort of the bright light leading the league into a new collaborative and successful future, is now the head and spokesperson for a team that appears to be on the rocks, to say the least. He could not be the face of the league. And who knows if he's even personally on board with this lawsuit. We don't even know that. So I think the interesting thing is not Rocco himself, but who could have been that face? Who could have been that voice? It couldn't be Steve Malik for the reasons I said. And the very best person to put their front face forward is somebody who, because of what's happened in the league and with his club over just a short period of time, cannot serve that function. And I think in its own way, the person who was there yesterday and the person who was not there is a microcosm of what we've seen out of this league for 12 months.
Kardik, you know, that's probably the biggest question right there. Like, who is going to be the face of discussion here? And to try and, be a positive influence, maybe, you know, try to find out what's going on here. Maybe, you know, we're not children, obviously, you know, and I understand, you know, Camiso is a very proud person, what he's done in the business that he is in. But still, though, you know, I found it very, very disrespectful and disheartening because in a moment's notice, the good graces can turn very, very badly.
Yeah, and as I mentioned last night on the Tailgate Show, thank you for that plug, Neil, but Nipun and I were on. There is a track record with Rocco Camiso and his handling of journalists and people who covered the New York Cosmos this past season, specifically the TICC pod and Empire Soccer website. So it was an odd messenger to begin with to be delivering that specific message, which was, hey, U.S. soccer journalists, you haven't done your job. Do some investigative reporting, and maybe you're scared about getting your credentials pulled. I mean, he said that very matter-of-factly and loudly and clearly, and right away my thinking is, knowing his track record, which a lot of people on the call may not have known, but Nipun certainly did, and Nipun had already asked a question at that point, was that it was a bit of a defense mechanism, and it's a situation where the NASL is not, some of the people in that room are not self-aware enough. They rightly point out some very serious things about MLS and U.S. soccer, which we'll get into in this show. I don't want this whole show to be about this press conference yesterday, which was which did not help.
Oh, no, of course not.
But you know, as we're on that subject, there's a lack of self-awareness sometimes where they are in a bubble and they are projecting some of their own issues onto other leagues and other people. And in the case of Rocco Commisso, he's the one with the established track record of trying to intimidate those who cover his team. I should say in past tense when you talk about the Tick Pod, and those who were supporters of his club. Now, backtracking to the optics or the sound of the press conference, I think they probably had this thing scripted, honestly, and they started out of the gate pretty well. Richie Sagal, the interim commissioner, read a very strong statement. You can agree or disagree with his opinion, the opinion he expressed about, you know, the playing field right now in U.S. soccer, but which certainly stuck out the NASL's position very, very articulately, very, very clearly. Then you have Commisso give his opening statement. I think there was a bit of victimization in his opening statement, but whatever. It was his opening statement that we thought would be the last we'd hear from him. And then Kessler starts getting into the legalism. We were under the impression, those of us who were in this press conference, that Jeffrey Kessler was going to handle every question as the attorney of record for the NASL in this legal action. And what ended up happening was Rocco Commisso decided he was going to get his two cents in. Now, I think this goes back to somewhat of the dysfunction of the league. They had the first 10 minutes of this press conference scripted well, did a good job with it, and it's going about in a very orderly fashion, whether you agree with their premise or disagree with their premise. But then it became chaotic. It became chippy. It became defensive. It became about victimization. It became about perhaps defense mechanisms and projection and all these things I mentioned a minute ago, which to me is the NASL in a microcosm. This will set us up for the rest of the conversation. Do I believe much of what the NASL alleges about Major League Soccer and U.S. soccer and collusion is accurate and might hold up in a court of law? Yes, I certainly do believe that. But do I believe that is the reason why the NASL is in the position they're in today? No, most certainly not. And I think that's kind of a good framework for the discussion, at least from my perspective of this situation.
And now an exclusive question to our other guest is, of course, Nipun Chopra. Nipun, are you all right? Because it seems like you Nipun, is everything all right? I mean, first it's Ted, and now it's Rocco. I don't know how all these daggers are aimed at you, sir. You're brave enough for me, I'll tell you that much.
I don't think it's that bad, really. It wasn't just directed at me. It wasn't a personal thing at me. It was a criticism of soccer media in general. Some of it might be true. Some of it was unfair. And really, I said this on the show yesterday. I'm completely over that whole thing. I genuinely just want to talk about like the merits of this lawsuit, because at the end of the day, this is not really about Rocco Commisso even, and definitely not about me. It's about this lawsuit, and not enough of us, and myself included, have talked about the merits and lack of merits in some cases of this lawsuit. Maybe with the exception of Neil Morris, a lot of us have focused on the theatrics of it all, which understandably have been entertaining. But at the end of the day, we have to move on. And genuinely, I'm ready to move on from the whole conversation about Rocco's tone and all that stuff.
Well, I want to move forward as well, because this is not the area I was trying to get to. When you put the whole press conference in, I legitimately want I want to discuss the merits of this lawsuit because it's very important to know why the NASL feels like this, or at least those that are a part of the NASL, that they feel that this Division II sanctioning being stripped from them is a major threat. And right now it only feels like the only person or the only party that's feeling threatened by this is the Cosmos, or at least Rocco Commissio. Is there enough merit here to say that they might absolutely get a verdict, or at least to have it being discussed for a good while before there is a verdict?
Oh, my. Well, the answer to that question would take the rest of the show. and I'm probably going to exercise a little bit of liberties in my answer at this point. The short answer to your question is, if this lawsuit is seen through to its end, yeah, there's a lot that could result. There's a lot of legitimate arguments regarding the proper role and function of U.S. soccer in professional soccer in this country. That has long been kind of this, you know, known secret. I don't know if that's the right phrase, but it's been something that people have just kind of dealt with, because who's going to rock that boat? I mean, anyone who has an interest in rocking that boat also has an interest in not running afoul of the powers that be. So, I mean, that's. You know, you kind of have to have a perfect storm in order to have that. Of course, this is also the kind of lawsuit that can take years and years and years to, that can fully litigate, and a lot of resources. So that's the other part. So, and that really, you know, in my mind, I've sort of divided, because I've been wrangling myself of trying to process and figure out a way to explain this lawsuit in a digestible way for the last week or more. And I'm still doing that. I think that where I've come down is, I'm best viewing it in three stages, or at least three parts. The first is the preliminary injunction stage, which I'll address in a minute, because I've got some opinions on that. The second is, if you get past that and get to the full litigation stage, it's the question of whether U.S. soccer is subject to antitrust exemptions under the Stevens Act for its regulation of pro soccer. It's a very wordy question, but it is paramount to this entire discussion. And if you get past that, or if the NASL gets past that, it's then whether the divisional tier structure and the standards that they have imposed in between those tiers are lawful and unlawful pro-competitive factors or unlawful restraints of trade. So that's the third part. But before we get to any of that, we've got the preliminary injunction stage, and which is coming up sometime in October, maybe with a decision sometime in early to mid-November. And that is where a lot of people, a lot of legal scholars, and if you listen to Jeffrey Kessler yesterday, even he put a lot of weight on the outcome of that. And here's why that is. A lot of people have said, well, These teams that still want to be in the NASL cannot function at D3 because it is not commensurate with the amount of money that they put in their club, or the status of their club, or it's not what they bought into when they joined this league and when they purchased their team, and it's just not something that's tenable. I'm sure that on a superficial level that's true. But I want to get past that argument, because I think other than superficially, it's a bunch of hogwash. Here's what's really going on with the preliminary injunction. Number one, there's two real reasons of why this is being requested and why it's being requested now. Number one, you know, the timing of this lawsuit came before a decision was made on USL's D2 sanctioning for next year. And there's a good argument that, you know, maybe that, you know, NASL's assertion about favoritism being shown to USL would have been stronger if they had waited and seen what happened with USL. And if obviously they granted USL D2 sanctioning with waivers, and they didn't for the same. They didn't with the NASL. That's pretty blatant. But they chose to file this lawsuit and seek an injunction prior to a final decision being made for USL. And the opinion of many folks, including myself, is that that was made to shine a spotlight on that decision and probably influence U.S. soccer to treat the USL the same as NASL, meaning don't think you're going to get away with giving them D2 sanctioning for next year with waivers. You're not just going to get to waltz into that. So it was probably an effort to kind of get one over on USL, which, you know, if you're in NASL, I don't know if I can blame them. But let's be real. That's the first reason. The big reason of why they want preliminary injunction and maintain a D2 status is not because all these teams can't stomach the notion of playing D3. It's protection of assets. The members who are still in the NASL, if they lose their D2 sanctioning, it is the consensus opinion from people who have covered this league and read these membership agreements and talked to folks around the league, is that any fee to then exit the LLC drops significantly if NASL does not retain its D2 sanctioning. And all the folks who have an interest in sticking around this league lose money if members decide to then jump ship. I mean, we've got an idea of some that may be contemplating it, but it could be the floodgates opening, because even if some of these owners are inclined to stay with the league, given the cost of maintaining this league, the cost of dues, the cost of propping up teams, the uncertainty of the sanctioning process, and now the fact that you're knee-deep in a lawsuit against the Federation, how many of these owners are going to say, yeah, let me see this through, let me stick around? And how many are going to take advantage to get out for next to nothing while they can? Even if some of these owners may be still partial to the league, it would be almost business malpractice to not protect themselves that way. So, on the flip side, folks who want to see it through to the bitter end, whether it's Rocco Commisso, and again, we don't know, it's speculating, Rocco Commisso, maybe Silva, maybe Pfaff, maybe Palmer, I don't know. But if these members of the LLC have to then pay, let's just use a figure of $2 million to get out of the LLC. Well, let's say there's 10 members in the league, and somebody has to pay $2 million because the NASL gets an injunction and maintains their D2 status. Well, that $2 million divided by the 9 remaining members is about $220,000 per team. That's not chump change at the D2 level. So this is about protection of assets, because they know that if they lose their D2 sanctioning, members are going to jump ship. They're going to be able to jump ship for next to nothing. The people who are still left holding the bag are not going to get commensurate payment for these people that are leaving. And they know that there's few teams that are really want to jump in this league now that they're in litigation of the NASL. That's what this preliminary injunction is all about. It is about protection of their asset. And I'll be very quick. I know I'm giving a long answer, so I apologize. It's also about the fact that D3 is untenable because of competitive aspects. There's already another league by Peter Wilton, Club 9 Sports, that is angling for D3 sanctioning in the not-so-distant future. The NASL is not going to want to compete with them. That's not good business. A lot of people have pontificated that these teams should just go down to D3, merge with NISA, and reconstitute the D3 level. Heck, I've said that. What we don't know, and I don't think anybody has said this, so I think it's worth saying, what we don't know when you look at Rocco Commisso or Robert Palmer or Ricardo Silva or any of these other folks who joined the NASL because of their organizational and governance structure and their independent model, if you want to call it that, what we don't know is exactly what the NISA model is, okay? Peter Wilt has said on my podcast and other places that NISA will operate more like the NASL than USL. Okay, well, more like, what does that mean? That means it won't be a pure franchise model like USL, But does it mean it's going to be a pure LLC where each member of the organization has equal voting rights like the NASL? I doubt it. If Peter Wilt's smart, it won't be, because that's not a formula for success. I don't think that Club 9 Sports is getting into this for benevolence sake. They're going to want to make money. Where are the entry fees going to go to? They're going to be divvied out equally among the member clubs? Maybe, but I'd be surprised. So that's what we don't know, is when we talk about these clubs merging with NISA, we don't know what they would be merging into, and we don't know if Rocco Camisa would find that palatable. So that's a long answer, but I wanted to sort of get out there my feelings on the preliminary injunction stage, because that's really what this is all about at this stage.
I want to go to Nipun first, because I want to talk about Indy 11. And Nipun, after everything that's been digested about this lawsuit, what have you heard from the ownership group of Indy 11? I mean, are they – I mean, I'm not asking you, do you know if they're with, you know, the NASL on this or not? But what have they've said, depending on what happens at the end of this calendar year for 2018? Do you feel they're going to stick around and – maybe stick with NASL if they do go to Division III, or do you know they're ready to make a move to USL, that it looks like they're going to stay Division II anyway?
What I do know is that people close to the team and people involved in the team are actively encouraging Ersol to think about, or honestly, move to USL, but I don't know what Ersol's thought process is, and ultimately it is Ersol's decision, and he is supported by Mr. Jeff Belskis, who, well, maybe I shouldn't say anything. But at the end of the day, it's going to be Ersol's decision, and I don't know how it's going to play out, because we don't really have any access to Ersol. I certainly have never spoken to Ersol, and his reasons for staying with NASL have been widely rumored, and they continue to be widely rumored, because in a lot of ways, joining USL, given the possibility of local rivalries such as Cincinnati, such as St. Louis, and such as Louisville City, would make a lot of sense for Indy 11. But I don't know truthfully what the reasons are for Ersol's adamant to stay with NASL. We will see how rigid he is in his belief. My best guess is that he will stay with NASL as long as possible, and if things don't work out with his injunction, that he will jump ship to USL. So really, my best guess is that the future of Indy 11 hangs in the balance in terms of the injunction.
Kartik, I want to throw this out at you, if you don't mind, because you've watched our sport grow just as, for a long, long time. When U.S. Soccer decided to give provisional Division II sanction to both NASL and USL, and then the stories coming out that USL was bringing back the D3 League, Peter Wilt's Club 9 Sports Group is building the NISA League that would also be considered Division III. I felt that U.S. Soccer, regardless, even before this whole situation popped up, I thought we were going to see two leagues in Division II, two leagues in Division III, and MLS would just be the first division, no ands, ifs, or buts. It's all cut clear and dry. And then this happened. Were you shocked? And I know you were talking with Neil Morris on his podcast a couple of weeks ago about it, but seriously, though, were you shocked that they actually made a move like this?
Yeah, I was. This lawsuit has been tossed around for a long time. It's been tossed around for 2.5 years now, the talk of it. And obviously, a lot of the things we saw in that preliminary filing when they filed the lawsuit a week and a half ago are dated. I mean, you can even tell the bullet points were probably some of those items were compiled in 2015 for the initial thought of filing this lawsuit. That all having been said, I just think it's such a act of desperation and last rites almost of passage into the next world to file this lawsuit against your governing body. That's why I never really took seriously the threat. I thought that the threat of litigation was consistently used. And think about it from a foreign policy standpoint. Presidents say you can't take the threat of using force off the table. It gets you a better diplomatic solution, right? In dealing in any of these foreign policy discussions. I had long thought the NASL threat of litigation against the U.S. Soccer Federation, an antitrust lawsuit, was a bargaining chip. And it was a bargaining chip to be used and bargained with and played properly at the right time. So I suppose when you think of it that way, they were out of chips because they had had their sanctioning pulled and they had made the decision that they were not going to reapply in this 30-day period in the month of September to try and get that sanctioning for 2018 reinstituted, and they had gone with this seeming nuclear option. Yeah, I have to say I was surprised because for a member league to sue its governing body in the global game in world football is largely unprecedented, but it is also, I should point out, very unique and exceptional the way the game is structured in the United States, which goes right back to the heart of the NASL's argument. And what Jeffrey Kessler said yesterday, which I tend to agree with, or at least agree with part of it, that the U.S. soccer, the game in this country is structured differently than the sport of soccer or football anywhere in the world. He said it's different than any football structure anywhere in the world. I believe that is an accurate statement. I also believe it is probably true, although Kessler obviously would know a lot more about this than I would, that the way Major League Soccer's relationship with the governing body and the way the professional soccer leagues in this country are structured are different than the way any sport is governed in the United States. Now, I'm not absolutely sure that's correct. Jeffrey Kessler is alleging that. But I think that there's probably some truth to that as well.
And that's why we have a mediator with us right now, Kartik, and that's Neil Morris. He doesn't just report on soccer. He mediates it as well. And Neil, you know, it's just one of those things where maybe you should take off your mediation hat and maybe go in as a poker player. Do you think the pot is very short for Comiso and the NASL, and they're going to go all in whether they like it or not? Or do you think maybe there's a second ace in the deck somewhere that they can use it?
Well, I'm not sure they played the first ace yet. I mean, I guess we're assuming that this lawsuit is that, but that's less playing an ace than just kind of turning the table over. You know, I don't know. Again, approaching this from sort of a legal point of view, these kinds of lawsuits usually don't go to full hearing and decision. I mean, they find a way to get resolved either through settlement or technicality. If you go through all the lawsuits over the years, some of which have addressed this very issue of U.S. soccer's legal role within the pro soccer environment. You know, there was cases in the 60s and 70s that didn't get to that question because they settled. Back in the NASL, the original NASL days, the Champion Sport case got to a discussion of it in front of the judge, where U.S. Soccer adopted some very tortured analysis to say why their antitrust exemption under the Stevens Act should extend to the regulation of pro soccer. That case is not be fully litigated, but it takes such a long time. I mean, it's not months, it's years, and it takes a lot of resources. And, you know, it's an open question whether the NESL, even if they get that D2 status that I discussed earlier, will be able to continue as a league. Are all these teams going to stick around for this? Will some of these owners, even if they have to jettison a chunk of change to get out, they may do it. I can think of one who may do that. Is there going to be any intake? Are investors going to join this league during the pendency of a lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation? I mean, you know, a lot of folks you read on social media seem to think like, well, sure they will. What's the big deal? You got to be kidding me. I wouldn't. Who would want to jump into that instability unless they have this unending and an undying need to own a soccer team, and they have absolutely no other path. Why would you? I mean, that's the real problem. It's you know, I think that the, you know, Kessler's probably been itching for this fight for years, so he's more than happy to go ahead. Rocco Camiso, I mean, heck, what else is he going to do? I mean, he's fine trying to upset alcohol. Ricardo Silva, probably the same. I mean, those guys could continue to bankroll this as long as it's necessary. So that, I think that's why this has a chance to go the distance. But they may be litigating for principle only on behalf of a zombie league by the time it's all done. It won't be for a league that's going to continue to subsist at the D2 status with a full complement of teams for 3 years. I mean, maybe that happens, but it would be surprising.
Yeah, we'll see what happens then. Kardec, just to go to you here again, isn't it interesting how, you know, of course, Kardec wrote the book Soccer Wars with a Z. You know, it's always amazing to see what has happened in the past, what's been going on now, and the level it's reached right now. I mean, we all know USL took their medicine. They went to Division III, and then all of a sudden they pop, you know, they are able to come back as Division II in a provisional sanctioning. But then all of a sudden now, I mean, I don't know what's happening with them. I mean, I'm assuming they're going to get Division II once their meetings are done, whenever those meetings are with U.S. Soccer. But have you ever seen it this bad internally?
No. We don't know that USL is going to be a Division II next year. I suspect they might. If I had to make a guess, I would say they keep Division II with provisions. I don't think they get full Division II sanctioning. But that's just my hunch based on the people I'm talking to. The Federation has surprised all of us in the past with some of the decisions they've made. But they very easily could drop USL to D3, do the same thing with them that they've done with NASL. They might give them full D2 sanctioning with several waivers. I tend to think that's not going to happen, that USL will be forced in 2018, entering into 2019, a year from now, to jettison the teams when they start their D3 league, the teams that don't meet D2 qualifications. I feel like U.S. Soccer will require them to drop those teams to Division III. But that's a discussion for another day. Has it ever been this bad internally? It's I don't know. In this sport, we keep shooting ourselves in the foot. You know, I don't want to get all rosy and idealistic here and utopian, but we're not American football. We're not baseball. We're not basketball. We're a sport that has had to come and emerge from the shadows. And we're on the cusp of being a mainstream sport in this country. We're just about there, but we're not there yet. And I had always thought that there was kind of a sense of purpose and a sense of being among people who invest in the sport in this country and the people who govern the sport in this country. It falls on both. I'm not saying, hey, the NASL should play ball because they should unite for the greater good. It also is on the U.S. Soccer Federation to not play favorites, not collude with one of the pro leagues for financial reasons or for maybe reasons related to keeping certain factions in power and keeping certain officers in the U.S. Soccer Federation elected. You thought there was a greater good when it comes to this sport. But here's the thing, and we have to look at Chuck Blazer, unfortunately, Daniel. We have to bring his name up, and I figured his name would come into the discussion tonight. There are people like Chuck Blazer who got into this sport when this sport was very small in this country and it was easy pickings to make money. There are still a lot of those types of people who came in through the game through being a soccer dad, in Westchester County in the 1970s, who went to their first Cosmos game at Giant Stadium in 1977 or 78 and said, hey, you know, this is an emerging thing. It'll be easier for me to break in and make a lot of money doing this than if I go traditional route, baseball, basketball, football, American football. And I think we still have a lot of those people in the sport in this country, both at the governing level and match promotion promoter level, and also involved with the various leagues, who don't have a bigger picture, global macro view of our place in American sporting culture and our place as American soccer in the global game of football, where we are. I don't want to say we're insignificant, but we're not. We're certainly. I mean, we're on our way, but we're not where we want to be. We were not where I thought we'd be in 2017. If you had asked me in 1998, after that World Cup debacle and after Steve Sansom got sacked, where do you think we'll be 20 years from now? We have a Project 2010. I thought we would be much further along. I thought MLS would be much further along than it is right now. So I think we have too many people in the game in this country. I know this has been a roundabout answer, and it's a bit off topic, that have their own ego in mind, have their own financial bottom line in mind, and haven't looked for out for the greater good of the sport. And that creates these sorts of factions and infighting and things that keep holding this sport back. And there is no question to me right now that there is plenty of blame to go around on both the sides of both parties. If we're just talking about it, not from a purely legal standpoint, but from this infighting standpoint, on both sides of this dispute, the U.S. soccer side and the North American Soccer League, both have not come together for the greater good of the sport in this country and growing the footprint of this sport.
Nipun, would you say, because as we all know, whoever's officiating a match, it doesn't matter what level it is, MLS, NASL, USL, PDL, NPSL, U.S. club soccer, in any league in any country in this world, and I'm going to try and piggyback a little bit what Kardik has been saying, you know, each referee interprets the laws of the game their own way. And it seems like not just a referee interprets the laws of the game, or at least interprets the game in their own way on the playing pitch, but you would have to say, at the same time, whoever is in power or whoever is running the sport, it's kind of like that as well in a certain way. Would you agree or disagree?
No, I like that analogy. I mean, obviously, the way things are run are always open to interpretation, and rules and laws are really open to interpretation, which is why you have a judicial system. Well, that's not the only reason you have a judicial system, but that is a part of the reason you have a judicial system, is to modify and interpret what the law means. No, I think that's fair. I think in general, you're right.
Wow, I won the argument. All right, here we go. Well,
I'm curious, in what way were you applying that to this current situation? Do you mean USSF has interpreted?
You know, it's just like, you know, Rocco thinks, you know, I have to survive him. You know, he has to survive as Division II. You know, what's going on with this, all this colluding, if there is any, you know, MLS and U.S. soccer and USL are being, you know, basically they're all together, even though USL, we don't know what's happening yet with them, with being in division sanctioning and stuff. I just feel like, you know, what makes this lawsuit, I guess, valid, depending on whose interpretation it is through this, and where do you see it?
So overall, obviously, this question is best for Neil Morris. Let's all agree on that. But my opinion, non-legal opinion, is that there seems to be validity to portions of it. First of all, number one portion to me is the connection between MLS, SAM, and USSF. I think there's strong evidence for that. I think there's strong evidence for the idea that that we know USL and MLS have financial ties. So there is conjectural evidence. There are little bits of this that are true. you know, I think you can make a very strong argument based on, I should know this because I've read this damn thing so many times, but towards the start of the lawsuit, there's a particular paragraph that shows how many votes or what percentage of votes, I think it's 57% of votes come from MLS. So you can say with some degree of confidence that MLS has a, well, you can say with strong degree of confidence, MLS has a voting majority, and therefore an MLS narrative drives the decisions that, about soccer in this country. Therefore, there are merits to all those arguments. The part that is missing and the part that maybe people in NASL believe that is obvious, but I don't think it's obvious, is connecting those correlations. So, yes, there's connection between MLS, USSF, and some, and who knows whether it's Sunil Gulati, that's a totally different thing. Yes, there's connection between MLS and USL. Yes, MLS has a majority. But is that anti-competitive? That is the question that a lawyer and a judge can only answer. From my perspective, there's strong circumstantial evidence here, but I don't see a smoking gun just yet.
Okay. Well, I guess that's the big one that I would probably say is the biggest question of all. But, you know, Neil, where – and Carter can – and any of you can jump on in on this question because this is really more for everybody, I guess. And, you know, where have we seen U.S. soccer getting, I wouldn't say hammered, but thrown at them, two separate lawsuits, one aimed in, you know, U.S. district court and the other one in international court. And, of course, I'm talking about the Pro-Rel lawsuit that has been thrown out there by Silva with Miami FC and, of course, Mr. Crowley over in Kingston, New York. Where we've ever seen anything like this, gentlemen, where the U.S. Soccer Federation has to handle two separate lawsuits on two separate discussions, and, you know, is it just such a headache just to follow everything that's been going on here, and will we ever get to any answer or conclusions to these types of discussions? Neil first, and anyone else who wants to jump in, go right ahead.
Have we ever seen this? I mean, probably not. I mean, I don't know that the U.S. Soccer has ever been taken on this issue to the Court of Arbitration for Sport on the question of promotion and relegation. I mean, there could be and maybe this is a good time to mention this aspect of it. There's a significant question about the interplay between these two actions, whether one affects the other. It was one of the questions that was summarily dismissed yesterday at the media conference, and I apologize for a kid who asked the question, but they essentially said, you know, what is does that action impact this lawsuit or vice versa? And Jeffrey Kessler was like, well, you know, ask Miami FC that question, which is a ridiculous answer. I mean, he's as capable as anyone to talk about whether the potential outcome of that arbitration impacts the aims of this lawsuit. And in my opinion, there's a conflict there. And again, I'm sort of skipping past my second and third parts of my legal assessment and going to sort of unintended consequence part of the discussion, but that's fine. You know, what's been the notion that's been raised is if you ultimately, you know, see this thing through and a court finds what they need to find and you don't have divisional structures that are promulgated and governed by U.S. soccer, you know, how then do you have promotion and relegation? Or more importantly, how do you have a sanctioning body that can require promotion and relegation? Now, many people, including myself, don't think that's going to happen anyway. But if FIFA said, for instance, yeah, you got to do that, again, my opinion, they won't. But let's just presuppose they did. Well, there's no legal apparatus in the United States for U.S. soccer if the NASL is successful in their litigation. My reading of this is that there is then no body with the sanctioning authority to force these private entities to situate themselves within a pro-rel structure, other than doing it voluntarily as contractual agreements between each league. There's no way to do it. No way. The only way that any kind of semblance of promotion or relegation could ever happen is, A, if individual leagues band together on a contractual arrangement to do so, which I don't see happening, because in a world without divisional tiers, which league is going to volunteer to be the one to be second and third banana permanently? Who's going to do that? Nobody. They're going to say, "Well, I'll just start a league and be the best." I mean, on my own. No one's going to do that. U.S. Soccer can't make them, because that would be clearly an unlawful restraint on trade if they don't have antitrust exemption anymore under the Stevens Act. The only way it could happen is a league to do it within itself. You know, people have pontificated over the years about MLS doing pro rel within itself with the MLS 1 and MLS 2 or maybe even 3. And I suppose other leagues could do that within their own corporate entity. They just create tiers within their own league. But who is the soccer public going to find that palatable, or is it going to seem like some real pale version of the actual thing? But that's the only way it could really legally happen. Again, unless leagues band together to do it. You know, people talked about, well, the NASL could survive, and then they could be one, they could be the top division, and NISA could be 2, and NPSL could be 3. Well, that's fine within a divisional structure. But if this NESL lawsuit is successful and that goes by the wayside at some point, you know, why would NISA say, yeah, we'll be second tier? why would they do that? They wouldn't. I mean, on a permanent basis. So I just don't see it happening. And oh, by the way, you also have to worry that if MLS and USL decided to do that, which I don't think is ever going to happen, then you also start talking about collusion and unlawful and antitrust violations on their part too within the market. So it gets to be a complete mess. My main point is that there is a conflict there, because the hopes and dreams of promotion and relegation, including this arbitration request on Miami FC, to me are in total conflict with the aims of this lawsuit.
Yeah, let me follow up on that, Daniel. That was actually specifically the question I wanted to ask yesterday at the press conference. It's the part of this lawsuit that has become the most conflicting and confusing to me. There's a lot in it, obviously, beyond this promotion and relegation piece, and the possible relief that comes from this lawsuit for the NASL if they were to win the case, which would be the removal of divisional designations in the U.S. pro soccer landscape. Given that one of their member teams has filed an action with the Court of Arbitration and Sports, a claim, in a concert, obviously, with Kingston Stockade, who is not an NASL team, but Miami FC is, to do something which would be, I think, in conflict with this. Because consider this. In the CAT claim that was filed by Miami FC and Kingston Stockade, they are looking for FIFA to enforce the current divisional designations in the United States by setting up a system or forcing the United States Soccer Federation, which is a FIFA member federation, to set up a system of promotion and relegation using specifically the divisional designations that we have currently in U.S. soccer. Now, of course, that could be tweaked. There could be amendments. There could be changes to the standards. But that basic framework. Now, if this lawsuit that the NASL has filed is successful, and Miami FC is a member of NASL's LLC, we don't know how they voted on the legal action, but now my interpretation, and maybe Neil could correct this if I'm wrong, my interpretation is that every member of that LLC is now, like it or not, part of this lawsuit, unless they get out of the LLC. So Miami FC is a party to a lawsuit, which would in fact put in place a completely contradictory framework if the court assigns the relief that the NASL is requesting. And they're not requesting monetary damages, as Jeffrey Kessler made very clear again yesterday to us. There are two forms of relief they're requesting, one of which is the removal of these divisional designations. And as he said, let the marketplace decide what is Division 1, what is the top league, what is the best league, which Right. I mean, on the surface, it's probably a death wish for NASL because they're not ready to compete with Major League Soccer in any way, shape, or form. But that's the relief they desire, so that's what they put in this lawsuit. But just think about that if you're out there listening and how that's directly contradictory to what Miami FC and Kingston Stockade have put in their – have requested in their CAS claim. And again, that's the question I most want answered, and we'll continue to try and ask around. And Kessler said yesterday, ask Miami FC, so I'm going to ask Miami FC, but I'd also still like an answer from the NASL on it.
And Nipun, you can chime in as well if you want me to reserve a question, or I know you have to get going soon, but what's your overall feeling about this?
Overall feeling is I think NASL has a real shot with the primary injunction. I don't know what happens after that. I'm not convinced that the NASL has as many teams as they claim they do. I'm not convinced. Well, let me rephrase. I'm convinced that there are multiple teams interested in the NASL. I'm not sure as many teams as NASL claims are ready to go are actually ready to go. So once, and like I said, I believe the primary injunction will come through for them. I don't know if NASL is able to deliver on the goods again. And I feel like we're ready. We're set up for another year of a lot of disappointment. In Rocco's statement yesterday, he said that if you know, that he believes that the league will be bigger and better, and there was another word, I forgot, maybe stronger next year if the league survives. You know, the thing is that for someone like Karthik, someone like Neil, I mean, they've been around this so long since, you know, the early days, that they must have heard promises like this every year from different people. I've heard it for 3 years now from different people. The identity of NASL 2 years ago versus 1 year ago versus now has basically flip-flopped in terms of their, you know, desire to be antagonistic or desire to be cooperative with the rest of the American soccer pyramid. So all these promises are made that everything will be fixed as long as we have D2. I mean, if the injunction goes through, I don't know. Come back to my original point. Yeah, if the injunction goes through, I'm not convinced, at least now, based on everything I'm hearing, that those teams are ready, and therefore we're probably setting ourselves up for another year of absolute madness and probably even more toxic because now you have basically warring factions again, and openly warring factions again. To USL's credit, they haven't really come out and responded to any of this. I think their silence and they just kind of seem to be just motoring along with whatever they're interested in, whatever they do normally. And but in general, we know they're openly warring factions, factions now. And, you know, it's just disappointing because for those of us who wanted a more cooperative NASL, I think that is done and dusted. Even if the league survives, we're back to the same old stuff.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you, Nipun, for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on to discuss these great topics of what's going on in the country and in our sport and our game. So I will definitely talk to you next time, and have a good evening. Thank you.
Appreciate it, and always great to talk to Neil and Karthik. Enjoy the rest of the show, guys. Cheers.
All right.
Thank you.
And that is Dr. Nipun Chopra from Sock Takes, as you know, over in Indianapolis. And we're still here with Carter Krishnar from World Soccer Talk and Neil Morris from WRAL SportsFan.com. Of course, he has his – say it again before I make that mistake, Neil. Your podcast name is called?
The Inverted Triangle Soccer Podcast.
Thank you. The Inverted Triangle Soccer Podcast. Thank you. Yes, I'll send you $5 and put in the cookie jar for me. Thank you. as we continue on here, Karthik, I think, Karthik, you know, with, you know, your following of what goes on in the Premier League, obviously, and what goes on in England and everything else, or maybe even in European football, have you ever heard or noticed a story where a league has filed some sort of a lawsuit against the governing body. Like, has there been, like, maybe football leagues 1 and 2? Have they ever sued the FA for, you know, anything as weird or as silly, maybe even as serious as what we are seeing here with what the NASL is doing against U.S. soccer?
No, there have been points of tension. There have been places where there has been tension, controversy, disagreements between the Football League, the Premier League, and the FA in England, and governing body, certainly between the Football Federation and in Italy and Serie A, in particular about the foreign player limit and things like that. There has been, but to actually take, I would note that those societies tend to be less litigious than the United States, a lot of those Western European societies, but that being taken out of the picture, even here, it is an extraordinary step for a member league. Because this is something that Neil talked about with Stephen Dank last week, Professor Stephen Dank, on the Inverted Triangle podcast. The argument as to whether U.S. soccer is a voluntary organization that you are voluntarily a member of, and the NASL was a member in good standing, albeit a member in good standing with a number of waivers. It's kind of unprecedented to be a member of a voluntary organization. You could interpret whether it's voluntary or whether it's a mandatory organization, because you won't get FIFA sanctioning, you won't get all of those things. But that's for the court to decide, for you to take on this legal action. And I thought something that Jeffrey Kessler said yesterday was curious, which was the analogy he made about, now that I'm thinking, he made it was in response to Nipun's question. So it's too bad Nipun's not on the line anymore. He made an analogy that the standards are unfair because Dr. Nipun Chopra, if it said you had to be 8 feet tall, you couldn't reach that standard, and no matter what you did. That was the argument he gave as to why the standards were arbitrary, unfair, and NASL couldn't meet. I wasn't sure, maybe Neil remembers, whether he was speaking of the Division II or Division I standards. I thought he was speaking of the Division II standards, which I found curious because the two things NASL has run afoul with, which is the number of teams and the time zones. And time zones, Kessler talked about being arbitrary, and Rocco talked about how there's only one time zone in Italy and how great Serie A is. But it occurred to me last season, in 2016, NASL had 12 teams, and they were in all the time zones they needed to be in because they had a team in the central time zone. In Oklahoma City, and if that team had continued in 2017, we wouldn't be having this. Well, they had a team in Minnesota also, but that team moved to Major League Soccer. They had a team in Oklahoma City that folded or is on hiatus. We don't really know because the league has never officially notified the media and the public as to what happened to the Oklahoma City NASL club. If perhaps they'll be back next season, I doubt that. But we were never officially notified. But the point is, they, if that team had continued this season and NASL had stayed at 12 teams, they wouldn't be having any of these problems. So the thing that struck me was that they're saying that the standards are arbitrary. That's correct. They are. But that somehow they're unfair. And the analogy that was given is if they say that you have to be 8 feet tall to be a reporter, you're never going to be 8 feet tall. The standard that the NASL has run afoul of, if they had just kept status quo with San Francisco coming into the league in 2017 and Oklahoma City not going out of business, they would have met that threshold and would have not have had this problem. And obviously that assumes that Fort Lauderdale, Tampa Bay, and Ottawa stay in the league as well. And obviously Fort Lauderdale is out, and Tampa Bay and Ottawa switched to USL.
Yeah. Neil, I mean, where have you ever seen anything like this in your life? I mean, especially what's going on and the whole college basketball situation that happened with University of Louisville and Rick Pitino and some of these other assistant coaches trying. I mean, obviously it's a different situation than what we're seeing here, but where have you ever seen anything like this in your life? I mean, you're not seeing Major League Baseball teams suing the league office. You're not seeing the NFL team suing the league office. You're not seeing the NHL suing NHL teams suing their league office. You're not seeing stuff like this. It's just weird to me how these situations have come up. And I'm not saying, oh, it's the NASL, it's typically them. I'm not saying that, but just like, you know, in a broader sense, I guess, how they have the guts to go after U.S. soccer for this when,
well, I mean,
you know, go ahead.
Here's the thing. I mean, sort of as a threshold issue, we've seen teams sue their league before. I mean, Al Davis and the Oakland Raiders sued the National Football League on at least one or more occasions regarding a variety of issues, including whether they had the freedom to move to Los Angeles. That was a lawsuit that had to be litigated, and they won. USL famously sued the NFL. I mean, there have been sport lawsuits throughout the course of sports history. I mean, go back to the history of baseball. I mean, back in the formation of Major League Baseball, was a bloody mess, legally and procedurally speaking. So, yeah, we've seen stuff like this before.
Mm-hmm.
Is it palatable? No. Now, to sort of draw an analogy to what we're talking about, you know, you say, well, you know, have you seen individual clubs suing their federation? Well, no, you don't, but there's a good reason for that. And that kind of goes to that segues into my second part of my internal analysis. You know, U.S. Soccer Federation occupies a unique position in the sporting landscape in the United States. They are tasked under legal fiat through the Stevens Act, the Amateur Athletics Act, to oversee. Under the auspices of the U.S. Olympic Committee, the administration of Olympic events and international amateur events within their given sport. They fill the same role as USA Basketball, USA Hockey, USA Gymnastics, USA Baseball. But none of those others exercise a position of authority over their pro analog, their pro sport. U.S. Soccer, in addition to being sanctioned to oversee Olympic and amateur international events under their authority granted by the U.S. law, also oversees the regulation of U.S. pro game under its affiliation and association with FIFA. So they occupy two different roles that none of these other organizations or federations in the United States occupy. And the question is whether U.S. law permits that second part, or at least permits it under the antitrust exemption of the Stevens Act, meaning that they can just do what they want in furtherance of regulation of pro soccer. I mean, that's really what this comes down to. And you had asked several times, kind of figuring out, you know, what the viability of this lawsuit is, or really what it's about, or really why it could have any teeth. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what you said earlier. Well, mm-hmm. this is the point where a lot of folks, including myself, including, you know, legal minds that I've had on my podcast and spoken to who are not necessarily prone to you know, bolstering the NASL or anti-U.S. Soccer Federation by any extent, this is where they think this thing has teeth, is the notion that the antitrust exemption granted under the Stevens Act to U.S. Soccer for the administration of Olympic events and international amateur soccer events does not convey to them the right to regulate pro soccer in a monopolistic way. And if that aspect of this lawsuit is successful, it doesn't mean that U.S. Soccer can't regulate pro soccer under their affiliation with FIFA. It just means they can't do it with antitrust exemptions, which means their ability to do what they do now is severely curtailed. It won't even, in my opinion, if you have leagues that pop up that want to press the issue, it will pale in comparison to what their role is right now. They won't be able to institute divisional tiers and adopt standards for that, at least on just a basic threshold gateway basis at most. This whole notion that they're going to be able to continue to team up and contract with MLS for, let's say, joint broadcast rights, no way. That's going away. There's no way that the U.S. law regarding the operation of monopoly would allow a nonprofit agency overseas Olympic and international amateur athletics to team up with one private pro entity for the pooling of broadcast rights to the exclusion of any other private actor in the stream of commerce. No way that happens. No way. And you can extend that to every other collaboration that U.S. Soccer has with the MLS or with any other actor in the soccer universe, because them doing that will be contracts and affiliations that are to the definition that are to the detriment from a competitive standpoint of other potential private entities. That's really where this comes down to. And frankly, it's on this point where I think that the NASL has a strong argument, just as these other lawsuits that I referred to over the years had strong points. And this is where this is the point where U.S. Soccer has the most fear. I mean, they won't admit it, but they do. Because if they lose their antitrust exemption, or at least the cloak of that has never been technically articulated by any court, if they lose that, it's Katie bar the door. If they manage to finagle an argument that allows them to maintain an antitrust exemption of the Stevens Act for the regulation of pro soccer under their FIFA mandate, oh, my goodness. I mean, first off, that's also a Katie bar the door. They could continue to do what they want to do. But it's also a very, very slippery slope, because it essentially means, conceivably, that any other sporting federation in the U.S. landscape could do the same thing, although there may not be an international actor that they would have that ability to do it. So it might not be as much of a slippery slope. But the legal analysis of this is that people like Stephen Bank and Steve Holroyd, they just cannot fathom a way where U.S. law could be interpreted that a nonprofit agency acting under the auspices of a foreign nonprofit agency could have a monopolistic right to regulate pro soccer in the country. And I agree. And I think that's where things really get hairy with this, if this lawsuit is seen to fruition. How that ends up benefiting the NASL tangibly is a completely different subject, because who knows whether they're able to even hold themselves together. But the long-term consequences of that in the pro soccer landscape, it's not the equivalent of sort of an atomic bomb, but it changes everything that we've seen regarding the way the interaction between MLS and pro soccer going forward.
And Cart, just to throw yourself in here for a second, I want to ask you this question. Just for the sake of argument's sake, let's say what Neil says does truly happen. Let's just say all of a sudden U.S. soccer, oh my God, we got an issue here and we got to find a way to prevent this from happening. I mean, I know he says that this probably won't happen, but what if it does? What do you think U.S. soccer is going to do? What will become of U.S. soccer if they do, let's just say, hypothetical sake, that they do lose the lawsuit against them? These changes might happen. What do you think is going to happen then?
Right. So then they would lose their basic antitrust exemption. What is not
right.
A codified antitrust exemption, by the way, to regulate pro soccer in this country, which, again, I agree completely with Neil and the guests he's had on the show the previous week, Steve Holyrod and Professor Bank, who think this is a real point of weakness for U.S. soccer. It's not codified in statute. The Stevens Act doesn't apply to professional soccer, in theory. or legally in code. So in U.S. code, this is a point of weakness for them. What would be the impact? Well, first off, I would argue, and again, I'm not an attorney, but I would argue that U.S. soccer currently, through their commingling and marrying of television rights with soccer via Soccer United Marketing with Major League Soccer is, in fact, improperly, well, I would say it's improper, but legally it hasn't been found to be this, is subsidizing Major League Soccer. So they're subsidizing a league, one professional league, the first division, but they're not subsidizing USL, the second division, or NASL, the co-second division, in a similar fashion, which means that they are playing favorites currently, you know, and playing with fire since they have an antitrust exemption. They're acting as if they have an antitrust exemption when it hasn't been codified. They lose the ability to do that, right? They lose the ability to prevent, let's say, a group of European investors, or let's not even say European investors. Let's say they lose the right if there are owners of Premier League and Serie A and Bundesliga teams and La Liga teams that want to start their own professional league in the United States, they really lose the ability to regulate that and shut that down. Yep. They lose the ability to arbitrarily set the sort of standards that they have done for the professional game in this country. They lose the ability to essentially funnel everything that happens in the sport professionally. Everything that happens in the sport in this country runs through them, amateur, professional. I think a big part of U.S. soccer's success, if you want to call it that, financial success, has to do with this this development academy and the youth system and how it's being operated in this country. That's a discussion for another time. But in terms of specifically the professional game, they're going to lose their ability to be anything more than just an annoying kind of outpost of FIFA's authority in the United States. I'll give you a place in context where they could be. Do you remember how ineffectual and ineffective and isolated the United States Soccer Federation was in the late 1970s when the North American Soccer League was essentially a rogue league, which had, in the New York Cosmos at the time, one of the most popular or visible football clubs in the world, one of the most visible American professional sports teams for about a 5 or 6 year period in this country. The U.S. Soccer Federation was sidelined because they had a league that was sanctioned as a first division, but wasn't really operating within the purview of the way U.S. Soccer and FIFA governed the game. U.S. Soccer was barely even able to organize a national team in that period of time. They were barely able to organize events. They weren't able to control the flow of money that came through their coffers when there were international friendlies held on U.S. soil. Now, this we know the amount of money they make from that thanks to the Champions World lawsuit, Charlie Stoletano and company against U.S. Soccer earlier this decade, about 6 or 7 years ago, that lawsuit, when that actually made it to court. This would, I think, severely affect U.S. soccer. Will they go back to the level they were in the late 1970s? Probably not, because the game is so much bigger in this country, and they have managed through their control of certain media elements to create a very nationalistic feel around the U.S. men's national team and U.S. women's national team, particularly the men's national team, and have made that the focal point of how so many people in this country view the sport. But in terms of being an actual regulatory authority and an administrative body, they will be very weak if they lose this lawsuit.
By the way, let me throw another elephant-sized monkey wrench into this discussion. Something that just occurred to me, and again, I'm coming at this from the perspective of I think there's legal grounding for the NESL's position on this issue. If you look at the other sports in America. I mean, when the ABA formed as a rival to the NBA, it wasn't D2, D3 with somebody telling them they were a certain division or whatever. They were competitive leagues and the marketplace chose. When the NFL, USL, same thing. And hockey has had the similar situations, and that's essentially what the NFL is saying should happen in U.S. soccer. But you mentioned women's soccer. Here's the elephant-sized monkey wrench, Kartik and Daniel. Think about the NWSL for a second. Suppose this goes through, and U.S. soccer cannot operate in a monopolistic fashion regarding professional soccer in this country. Suppose the next, you know, Magic Jack owner wants to start up a women's pro soccer league and says, I can't compete because U.S. soccer is funding the NWSL.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They have a rock-solid argument.
Yeah.
Rock-solid.
Yeah.
The NWSL, as currently constituted, now, again, it's always on unsteady ground for a variety of market reasons, although it's managed to put together, you know, a history of going back, you know, 4 or 5 years now. But if this goes through, if someone goes to court and says U.S. soccer is occupying an anti-competitive place in the market because they are funding a pro league in the women's game, they'll win that argument. There's no way that U.S. soccer could be allowed to do that under that auspices. And the only way they're doing it now is under this cloak of antitrust exemption that people have just allowed to happen. And if that goes away, there's an impact right there.
Yeah, Neil, actually, that's funny. As I finished my point up, I was thinking that I should have said that NWSL would be a league that would be dramatically affected because of Daniel, you probably don't cover the league as closely. Neil covers the league very closely. I cover the league moderately closely. There are several players on each club's roster that are subsidized directly by the U.S. Soccer Federation, a few by the Canadian Soccer Federation around the league, and Mexican.
Well, the league is subsidized.
And the league is subsidized, right. The league itself. That puts a position where if you get a Dan Barislow, the late Dan Barislow, as you mentioned, from Magic Jack, who is a rogue owner, he can just take his toys and start another league. And there would be nothing to stop him.
It's beyond that. He can start another league, but he can also say U.S. soccer cannot fund my rival.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
And I think in the women's game, this is particularly particularly interesting because the women's game doesn't have the structures across the board globally that the men's game does, and it could go very much the same route that other American professional sports have gone if you don't have some sort of antitrust exemption for U.S. soccer at the top regulating it. And you very easily could have a rival league that has a big money backer behind it. And obviously the one advantage that NWSL might still have is that they have a few of these teams tied to MLS teams that could pump money in, but who knows how much money they want to lose in that kind of battle. You could see a seismic shift in the women's game. And what happens in the women's game in the United States affects the women's game globally much more profoundly than what happens in the men's game in the United States affects the global men's game. So it could be massive from that standpoint, Neil. So thanks for bringing that up.
I mean, that's the one thing I think that are we all worried about this? I mean, should we worry about this? Because if you never know if you have a judge that might go a different route, guys. And I'm not saying, you know, I think there's validity, there's no validity. I'm just, you know, as a neutral in this whole situation, sort of a neutral in this whole situation, I just don't know, you know, what decision is going to come from this. And, you know, let's just say for the heck of it, NASL does win. And like you just said already, you know, that could be, you know, a big backbreaker, not just for all the divisions in the men's or boys leagues, but as you just said right now, the NWSL could be over. And how would, and then what would happen there? Would there be a, you know, a lawsuit by some of these club owners of the NWSL? I mean, we know that is with the cooperation of Canadian Soccer and the FMF in Mexico. I mean, what could happen in that aspect? because there's a lot of dominoes right now that could fall if it does go the other way.
Daniel, I have this question, and I actually want to ask Neil this question. U.S. Soccer, they must have lawyers they retain on staff that you would think police compliance with potential with the potential of being sued for antitrust violations and violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act. So if U.S. Soccer loses this lawsuit, given the behemoth they are, they have only themselves to blame for arrogance, reckless behavior, hubris, all those terms you can throw out. And again, I'm not exempting the NA. I mean, I've been very critical of the NASL, and I've said they're essentially a failed business. And if they really believe in capitalism, they have all this rhetoric about freedom and free markets. A failed business should fail, right? They're not too big or too important to fail. But you have to wonder, and I wonder this, Neil, wouldn't U.S. Soccer be policing themselves on these antitrust issues? Typically, wouldn't a governing body of their size be doing this regularly to see if they're in compliance themselves?
Restate that. I'm trying to think about that.
Wouldn't an entity like U.S. Soccer that is operating with an antitrust exemption that isn't actually codified for professional soccer, wouldn't you think they would be diligent internally in policing themselves to make sure they don't overstep their jurisdiction under the Stevens Act or the Sherman Antitrust Act? And if they do, what I'm saying, if they have and they get found guilty of that in this lawsuit, they only have themselves to blame for arrogance and hubris and all of those sorts of things.
Maybe. Would they have people policing it? Well, darn yeah, they'd have to. But I guess the larger point is that the porch becomes very short on what is allowable and what's not in the world of regulation of pro soccer in America. It's uncharted waters, to be honest, because there's an argument that they are still FIFA's arm in the U.S., but what does that mean? Where does that extend? Does it stop at the international competition grounds where they still have authority under the Stevens Act? I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But in the pro soccer area, do they have the authority? They would police, but I think their leash becomes very, very short on what they're allowed to do or what they're not allowed to do. And if they overstep it by just a little bit, if there's an actor out there that wants to call them on it, then they're subject to getting drugged to court. So it almost becomes untenable for them to try to assert themselves at some point. They don't necessarily recede to the level of U.S., USA Hockey or USA Gymnastics or whatever. Because what's interesting thing about the soccer landscape, we always talk about soccer being sort of marginalized or minimized in comparison to the other sports in the United States, which is true for the large part. But the one area where soccer, and I thought about this earlier this evening, the one place where soccer is paramount in comparison to those other sports in this country is in the area of international or national league, national team competition, with the exception of maybe USA Basketball. There's no other national team competition or sport that has the same scope and cachet and heft as soccer. And there's two reasons for that. One is on the men's side, it's connection to the larger global game and its popularity. And on the women's side, it's the history and the history of excellence on the women's side. So U.S. soccer will remain a key player in the sporting landscape just as an administration of Olympic events and international competitions because of soccer's heft in relation to other sports in that arena. So they won't be relegated to minor players. But I think their ability to sort of regulate the pro side becomes very, very short. And that's, they can have people trying to push the envelope, but if they've got people willing to push back, you know, at some point it becomes useless, and it ends up like the pro game, and maybe MLS becomes the NFL of soccer or of the MLB of baseball. You know, there's a lot of people that probably believe that, but the market, but you know, not to give credence to the parlance of Jeffrey Kessler and the NASL, but the marketplace would decide.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we'll see what happens when this whole thing comes to an end. As always, thank you very much for being on the show, discussing the toughest topics that American soccer can listen to. So hopefully we'll see what happens down the road. But right now it's just going to be very interesting to see what's going to happen with the NASL. Will they remain? Will they be gone? Will the teams die, or will they move on to USL, or maybe will they take the chance and join Peter Wilt's NISA? We'll have to wait and see. As always, thank you so much, and I will talk to you guys very soon.
Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome. Carter Krishnar from World Soccer Talk, as well as Neil Morris from WRAL Sports Fan, the Inverted Triangle Soccer Podcast host, Neil Morris. And, of course, thanks again to Nipun Chopra from Sock Takes over in Indianapolis. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to this special edition tonight. We'll try to get you more special editions down the road. We'll see what happens. Join me and Carter Krishnire and Robert Hay for Monday as we preview the last two games for the United States in World Cup qualifying. Can they beat Panama, and can they also beat Trinidad and Tobago on the road to try and go for the automatic spot for Russia? As always, thank you very much, everyone, for listening and trying my best to give everyone the best content possible here. My name is Daniel Feuerstein. This has been the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show special edition on Division II sanctioning being stripped away for 2018 on the NASL by U.S. Soccer. And, of course, the NASL promptly gives them a lawsuit. So join me this coming Monday night for another edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. Thank you very much for your night, for your attention. And, as always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody, and talk to you next time. Bye-bye for now.